It's great to have such a good crowd here today. This is both a subject and an expert that I'm glad all of you recognize are worth spending a time on a Wednesday afternoon to visit with. I'm Charles Freeman. I'm the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. Thanks again for coming. It says that I'm supposed to give opening remarks. I'm not going to do anything of the kind. I'm simply going to introduce somebody that you all know very well. Chris Padilla has been a fixture on the trade scene for many years, and his connections, at least with the subject on which he's about to talk, go back quite a ways as well. He was, when I first got back to Washington in the late 90s, I was up on the Hill working, and I thought it was kind of all that. I was working for a senator on the Finance Committee, and I was called up to talk about PNTR before, I think, the U.S.-China Business Council, and see where things were going on the front to pass permanent normal trade relations for China. And I gave this kind of off the cuff set of remarks. And sitting in the back was somebody who was kind of smiling sagaciously. And I said, that guy knows something that I don't. And that guy was Chris Padilla. And he knows lots more than I do, and has demonstrated that throughout his career, both in the private sector, both when he came to USTR in 2002 and was instrumental not just in keeping the fires lit on U.S. engagement with China, but also instrumental in passing the U.S.-Australia Free Trade Agreement, passing the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which, you know, continues to be, I think, the high watermark for this administration's activities on trade, and has gone on to be, if he can't take total credit, he says, for the phrase responsible stakeholder, but we can ascribe a significant amount of credit to him for Bob Zoellick's famous description of China. And when he was Deputy Secretary Zoellick's Chief of Staff at State, he has gone on to greater heights at Department of Commerce, both at the export side and now as leader of the whole kit and caboodle at the International Trade Administration. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Undersecretary Chris Padilla. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Charles. I appreciate that very nice introduction. I don't remember why I was smiling. Maybe it was a Friday afternoon and I had other plans, but Charles was very gracious. But when we served together at the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, Charles was Assistant USTR for China. I learned a great deal from him, actually, about China and about the enormous complexities of this relationship and the challenge of trying to manage that relationship and keep it on an even keel. And so when I wanted to take the opportunity to say a few words about the China economic relationship, Charles was the first person I thought of. He's doing a lot of great work here at CSIS. And I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to be here. A few years ago, I listened to a very good speech on China policy. It outlined in what I thought were very compelling terms why China's economic integration with the world is good for the United States, and it argued for what I thought was a very common sense policy of engaging China economically. And I remember one part of that speech in particular that I'd like to quote. The path that China takes to the future is a choice China will make. We cannot control that choice, we can only influence it. But we must recognize that we do have complete control over what we do. We can work to pull China in the right direction, or we can turn our backs and almost certainly push it in the wrong direction, unquote. Now, because of my background, some of you might assume that that quote came from a notable speech given by my former boss, Bob Zoellick, about China being a responsible stakeholder when he was Deputy Secretary of State. Certainly, you could be forgiven for thinking that, because the sentiments expressed in the quote are certainly consistent with the concept of encouraging China to play that role in the international system. But in fact, the quote that I read and those words were spoken on March 8th, 2000, by then-President Bill Clinton, in a very remarkable speech that I remember well that he gave at CICE outlining the case for permanent normal trade relations with China. In 2000, the United States was at a critical juncture in its policy toward China. We were facing, as many of you remember, a fundamental decision, whether to further integrate China into the global economy or turn away from decades of positive engagement. The immediate question was whether to pass PNTR and benefit from China's entry into the WTO. Supporters of PNTR understood that economic engagement presented the United States with a fairly unique opportunity to guide China toward peaceful integration into the global community. And after a very vigorous debate in Congress and in the country at large, a bipartisan majority agreed. Before 2000, Chinese goods were already enjoyed broad access in our markets. People forget that PNTR was mostly about opening China's market to our products. And it worked. It worked very well. China has grown to become, at the end of November 2007, it overtook Japan in the year-to-date data and became America's third largest export market and among its fastest growing. American exports to China have risen by more than 188% since 2001, a growth rate that far outpaces the growth in imports over the same period. Now, obviously, in absolute terms, the bilateral trade deficit with China is our largest and a consistent source of concern. Today, in 2008, the United States and China once again find themselves at what I think is a critical juncture in the relationship. This year, powerful groups in both countries will question the benefits of greater integration, and they will call for barriers to be erected between us. Economic nationalists in the United States will play on Americans' anxiety about the competitive challenge of China and the global impact that China's actions have on everything from the safety of kids' toys to the quality of air that we breathe in places like Los Angeles. But in a new development, the voices of economic nationalism are also speaking Mandarin. China has been more open than many developing countries, but there are increasing signs of policies in China that seek to direct markets rather than opening them. Here in the United States, support for engagement does not mean that we're blind to the enormous challenges resulting from China's economic rise. Just as the world watches closely when we hold an election or the Fed considers interest rates, which I think it's about to announce in 2 minutes, it's appropriate for Americans to watch for hints that China is backing away from open trade and economic policies. And I think there are three trends in this area that merit particularly close scrutiny. The first is a new network of policies that are being promulgated in China that appear designed to favor Chinese national champion firms over foreign competitors. And I'll tell you that this trend, more than any other, worries American business leaders in industries from steel to software. It's the thing I hear about the most from CEOs and representatives of business. It manifests itself in many ways. For example, there's a new anti-monopoly law that may exempt Chinese state-owned firms from the disciplines of competition rules. There are rumored technical standards for cell phone batteries that would make it virtually impossible for Chinese to buy the hottest American technologies on the market. Chinese regulators in industries like insurance and financial services routinely treat foreign firms more harshly than domestic ones. Foreign investment regulations are opaque and are combined with state subsidies to so-called pillar industries. And we're seeing the phenomenon of renewed government efforts in China to direct the market with price controls and quotas, resulting in widespread power shortages, transportation bottlenecks, and even gasoline lines in the world's fourth largest economy. All of these policies raise questions about the direction that China's leadership wants to take. Is it continued reform or a new brand of more insular thinking? The second concern and trend that we have to monitor is that China's regulatory structure has simply been unable to keep pace with the country's runaway economic growth. This shows up in a number of ways. One example is China's inability, or some would say unwillingness, to curb rampant, out-of-control piracy and counterfeiting. In 2006, an amazing 81% of seizures by the U.S. Customs Service of counterfeit goods came from China, despite repeated promises the Chinese government has yet to get this problem under control. Another way the lack of regulatory structure shows up is in China's clear struggle to create a modern regulatory structure to ensure product safety. Every day, we hear about a new recall of Chinese-made products. My own dog had occasionally eaten some of the pet food contaminated with melamine from China. My wife, 2 weekends ago, spent a good part of the weekend throwing away dishes made in China because the glazing on those dishes was beginning to come off. Consumers understand that most Chinese imports are safe, but they also want to know that China has adequate safeguards in place to deal with those products that are not. And China's response to date in this area has not inspired confidence. The government's initial reaction was simply to deny the severity of the problem and blame the media. I had a very senior Chinese product safety official say that the only difference between China and the United States is when they find a product safety problem, they don't go running to the press about it. Think about the implications of that statement for a moment for things like transparency and consumer safety. So initially, the reaction was blame the media, deny the severity of the problem. Then, just a couple of weeks ago, a very senior Chinese product safety official announced that, yes, there had been a problem, but it had been solved 4 months ahead of schedule, and there's nothing left to worry about. I have to tell you that such widely varying pronouncements do not build trust. Instead, they suggest that China's government does not yet fully understand that it must do the very long, hard, tedious work of strengthening its product safety regime, or otherwise put the Made in China brand at even greater risk than it is today. The third trend to watch is that China's significant economic imbalances could derail its own growth and significantly affect the United States and others. China suffers from excessive capital accumulation, growing inflation. Economic growth there is driven more by investment than consumer spending, partly because the lack of a social safety net has led to disproportionately high savings rates among Chinese households. The government still maintains a heavy role in the economy, and the state-dominated banking sector is burdened with lots of non-performing loans. Now, given these three challenges, growing economic nationalism, inadequate policing of the economy, and structural economic imbalances that affect the United States, it's not surprising that many Americans are concerned about China. And those concerns are reflected in Congress with numerous bills that have been introduced pending dealing with China. It is understandable that many in Congress want action. So does the administration. But as President Clinton pointed out in 2000, we cannot control or direct China's decisions. We can only influence them. So the question is, what combination of policies would be most effective in influencing Chinese behavior? The blunt instrument of punitive legislation won't work. Many of the pending bills are designed not to solve problems in China, but simply to reduce U.S. imports from China. And the bills are directed in a scattershot manner at particular symptoms of China's problems rather than at the root causes of those problems. Now, the Chinese currency has received particular legislative attention, and I will leave to my colleagues at the Treasury to discuss currency policy. Instead, what I will address are the challenges of requiring the Commerce Department to include an assessment of China's currency value in anti-dumping and countervailing duty margins, which is the core of many of the China bills that have been proposed in both the House and the Senate. Most of them that deal with the currency would require us to include that in either CVD or anti-dumping petitions. This is problematic, and it's problematic for at least four different reasons. First, I think it's important to keep in mind the central purpose of inserting currency judgments into trade remedy cases is to drive up the price of imports from China. That's the intent of these pieces of legislation. China is the single largest supplier of inexpensive products purchased by American consumers. And in this time of economic uncertainty, as Congress and the administration, even today, work together to stimulate economic growth, it would be very unwise to pass legislation that could inflate consumer prices. Second, there are serious operational questions about how the Commerce Department would administer a trade remedy regime that's based on currency valuation. The staff of our import administration works very hard to measure prices and subsidies, which they do every day. They try to do it in a transparent and objective manner. But I could pick up the phone today and I could call five economists who would give me five different opinions on the relative valuation of the renminbi. Some say it's undervalued by 40%. Others say 25%. Maybe we should just rely on the Economist's famous Big Mac Index, which last July found a 58% undervaluation of the RMB based on the input prices for a hamburger. But even the Economist's tongue-in-cheek method of valuing the currency depends heavily, by their own admission, on prices of local inputs which cannot easily be arbitraged or determined across borders. There are other operational problems as well. The bills require the Commerce Department to consider only how the currency affects the final price of products assembled in China. Discounting that a low Chinese currency simultaneously makes imports that China brings in of components and subassemblies more expensive. Remember that China, for many products, adds maybe 30 to 40% of the final value added is done in China. A lot of what they do is import components and materials, particularly from other countries in Asia, assemble them, and then send them to the United States. So we would be calculating an anti-dumping margin on the final price of a Chinese product based on an alleged currency undervaluation without having taken into account that all the stuff that they had to buy to make that product was more expensive because of a low RMB. Currencies work both ways. Similarly, currency valuation under these bills is only to be considered on a one-way basis. We're only to look at it in the Commerce Department, according to these bills, when there is alleged foreign undervaluation of a currency, with no offsetting effect when the dollar is relatively weak compared to overseas currencies. I can only imagine what would happen the first time a anti-dumping or countervailing duty petitioner appeals to the U.S. Court of International Trade, arguing that a currency valuation used in a trade remedy case was wrong. Do we really want judges to arbitrate the fair market value of the dollar against foreign currencies? Because that's what would be involved here. The third problem is that inserting currency values into trade remedy cases could open a Pandora's box of never-ending trade retaliation. This is not widely known, but the United States is actually the third largest victim of anti-dumping cases in the world. If we insert our own judgments on the value of foreign currencies into our trade remedy law, we would have to expect that similarly subjective countermeasures would be directed against our exports. And remember, we're the third largest victim of these cases around the world. It is not hard to imagine foreign trade bureaucrats using the relative value of the dollar as an easy excuse to erect new trade barriers. And this would be especially worrisome at this time when surging exports have been an important counterweight to the downturn in our domestic housing market. And it's important to realize there's a risk of multilateral retaliation as well. As Secretaries Gutierrez and Paulson and Ambassador Schwab pointed out in a letter to Congress last summer, certain provisions of these bills would raise serious concerns under international trade rules and could invite WTO-sanctioned retaliation against our exports. Finally, and I think this is the most compelling point, there is no evidence that the proposed bills would reduce the bilateral trade deficit, which, after all, appears to be one of the main motivating factors behind their introduction. Consider these facts. According to the Treasury Department, the RMB has appreciated approximately 15% against the dollar in real trade-weighted terms since the peg was abandoned in July of 2005. Yet over that exact same period, the Commerce Department reports that the bilateral trade deficit with China has increased by approximately 30%. So if the purpose of inserting currency valuations into trade remedy cases is to try to address the concern about the bilateral trade deficit, how do we explain the fact that we've already had a 15% appreciation since July of 2005, and yet during that time, the trade deficit has increased by double the rate of the appreciation of the currency? The deficit is driven, as many of you know, by many complex factors, including relative growth rates, relative interest rates, relative savings rates, and other things. The point is, passing currency legislation won't make the trade deficit go away. There's a better approach. It's been the policy of seven presidential administrations of both parties, and it's called economic engagement. And it provides the best, most flexible approach to a very complex set of challenges. The Bush administration is continuing the tradition of economic engagement with a three-pronged strategy that combines dialogue with the intelligent use of leverage. First, we're continuing our intensive dialogue with China through the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade and the Strategic Economic Dialogue. Both have proved to be effective vehicles. To address IPR concerns, China agreed in the last JCCT to require that computers be preloaded with legitimate software, and they've been cracking down on those that are not. We agreed to exchange information on customs seizures of counterfeit goods to focus China's enforcement efforts. China agreed to strengthen laws against company name misuse, a practice by which some Chinese firms have registered legitimate U.S. trade names under Chinese law. We've opened new discussions with China on things like its anti-monopoly law and other industrial practices. We've worked with some success to either cancel or delay China-unique technology standards, and we're taking concrete action against state subsidies. In the area of product safety, the Department of Health and Human Services signed an MOU with its Chinese counterpart at the SED, and at the JCCT, China agreed that there were loopholes in its regulation of bulk chemicals that are the underlying source of many counterfeit drugs, and it agreed to address those loopholes. My administration colleague, Treasury Undersecretary Dave McCormick, is in New York today speaking about China's macroeconomic imbalances. That is a particular focus of the Strategic Economic Dialogue, providing us with ways to discuss those issues. In addition to these dialogues, the United States is also sharing ideas with our trading partners in Europe and Japan on China's role in the global economy. And I think such communication, particularly with the EU and Japan, will help us to figure out how best to respond to the myriad challenges that all of us face together from China's economic rise. Now, dialogue and engagement are producing some solid results that I've just talked about. But our strategy is not one-dimensional and cannot be. We're backing words with action, and we're taking tough measures to enforce our rights under the WTO and under trade remedy laws. And that's the second prong of our strategy, WTO, to make full and effective use of the WTO dispute settlement system. This administration launched the first case against any nation, or by any nation, against China at the World Trade Organization. And we'll continue to exercise our rights under the dispute settlement system when it's necessary to do so. The United States has brought five cases against China, two of which have been settled on favorable terms, and three of which are still pending. Cases launched by the United States go to key issues like protection of intellectual property rights, discriminatory taxation, state export subsidies, and market access for everything from auto parts to audiovisual goods. The third prong of our strategy is to make full and effective use of U.S. trade remedy law, vigorously enforcing our laws against anti-dumping and government subsidies. Last March, the Commerce Department reversed a 23-year-old policy of not applying countervailing duty orders against Chinese imports. As a result, we've initiated seven CVD investigations of government subsidies to Chinese industries thus far, in industries such as paper, steel, chemicals, tires, and others. Meanwhile, we're continuing to enforce the anti-dumping law. We have more than 60 anti-dumping orders against imports from China in effect, and products from China are at issue in about half of all the ongoing AD/CVD investigations by the department. The three-pronged approach that I've just outlined offers a comprehensive strategy to influence Chinese behavior on everything from specific market access issues like technology standards to broad macroeconomic concerns like savings rates. It combines dialogue with tough enforcement, and it can be calibrated very carefully to respond to Chinese actions. And it can be combined with the efforts of other major trading partners to bring constructive multilateral pressure to bear. Punitive legislation, on the other hand, would accomplish none of this. Instead, such measures run the risk of inflating consumer prices at a time of economic uncertainty, bringing about trade retaliation that would stifle our exports, which are a critical engine of economic growth right now, and setting back our efforts to promote reform in China. While running all of these risks, punitive legislation would, as I said earlier, do nothing to reduce the bilateral trade deficit. 8 years ago, the United States made a very fundamental choice. After a vigorous debate in which many of us participated, a bipartisan majority agreed that America should not try to isolate China, but rather should encourage its deeper integration into the world economy. At that time, U.S. exports to China were only about $16 billion a year. Today, they are almost quadruple that. But while our exports have grown, so have tensions in our bilateral relationship. The Bush administration will not ignore those tensions, nor will we attempt to minimize them. Congress and the administration share concerns over many aspects of China's economic rise. The question is how best to address that competitive challenge and to influence Chinese behavior. Today, as in 2000, it would be a mistake to adopt policies that would, as President Clinton then warned, almost certainly push China in the wrong direction. As then, there is much anxiety in the country about the challenge of Chinese competition. As then, we face a fundamental choice about how to manage our relationship. And as then, the right choice is clear. Economic engagement with China remains in our national interest. Thank you very much.
That was terrific. Undersecretary Padilla has graciously agreed to accept some questions, if there are any. Chris, do you want to?
Thank you. This new bipartisan trend of quoting President Clinton favorably—it's amazing.
It was a good speech.
Yeah, so was this. Yeah. My question: the currency problem on the Hill. You know, isn't just a standalone thing, is it? If you're going to ask them to back off from currency legislation, it's got to be part of this larger package of trade that started to be negotiated now in public and in private. I just came from Senator Baucus's speech at Fred Bergston's shop, and he laid out very clearly what his price is, what has to be in TAA, and all that sort of stuff. Do you see the organic connection here? If you're going to ask them to not do China currency, what are the connections that you see that you're going to have to offer and give in order to have rationality prevail? I think we've all learned that, unfortunately, rationality just by itself isn't necessarily sufficient. Thanks.
Well, I've heard this a lot, and I honestly believe that these issues should stand on their own merits. I tried to outline just now why I think it is fundamentally in America's national interest to continue with economic engagement, and why I think that our three-pronged strategy is the best, most flexible way to do that. It seems to me those arguments on China policy should stand on their own merits, just as I believe that, as the President said the other night in the State of the Union, we should have trade adjustment assistance. It's a good program. president has called for its renewal, has called for improvements in it. That should stand on its own merits. So my general view here is to have tried to point out that while we understand the anxiety of the country that is reflected in the Congress about China, and that the currency in particular as a easily measured item is something that tends to attract special focus, our message is that we need to be very careful about what we're doing. And I tried to lay out the very real risks I see in inserting currency into the trade remedy system. And I think that those arguments should stand on their own merits. Yes, sir.
Harvey Feldman, Heritage Foundation. You mentioned, Secretary Padilla, about combining with other countries.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask about that. Are we combining with other countries to bring these complaints jointly to China? Are we combining with other countries to bring them to the complaint or the dispute mechanism within WTO?
What I would say is we're consulting with other countries about the broad range of issues regarding China, not just the enforcement measures, but I think it's important when we see a disturbing trend toward exclusionary industrial policies that we consult with other major trading partners like the European Union and Japan to ask them, are your companies seeing the same trend? I've done that with the Japanese. I was in Japan last December and did that. And it was a very useful discussion. We're going to be doing some more of that with the European Union here in the next few weeks. On your specific question about WTO cases, I think there's someone from USTR here. I seem to recall that the European Union did join with us on one of the cases that we brought against China. I'm looking around to see if someone's going to correct me. But auto parts, thank you. And so I think when we take a complaint to the WTO, it's fairly routine for us to consult with other major trading partners to see if they would like to join the case. So I would use the word, Harvey, I think I would use the word consulting rather than combining, because combining implies that we're somehow ganging up. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing is sharing information. And, you know, I read the Financial Times and I see, for example, that there is pressure from the European steel industry to launch countervailing duty cases in the European Union. Well, we've done that. And so it's useful for the two governments to share information on what we know about Chinese subsidies to that particular industry or about the opportunities and pitfalls of other areas of cooperation. Yes. Sir, and then maybe Dan. Yes.
Colin Clark with Space News. In the last defense appropriations bill, there was language calling for a look at the Chinese packaging of Long March launches. Is this rising to a level of interest in the administration yet, or is this still just a lobby pinprick?
It hasn't risen on my radar screen yet. Doesn't mean that it hasn't with colleagues at the Defense Department or the State Department. I think I've read press reports, but I've not had anyone come to see me about it. Dan?
I'm an inside U.S.-China trade. You talked about the second reason why you felt that a bill would be improper at this time is the sort of the resources that it would require to calculate the currency for these anti-dumping or countervailing duty cases, as well as the legal implications if that were to be appealed to the Court of International Trade. I'm curious, at the same time that you say that, Commerce is considering an MOE program, a market-oriented enterprise mm-hmm. program for individual companies, which 21 senators, bipartisan group of senators yesterday, said would completely eviscerate the AD program and would make it completely unworkable because you'd have to examine every respondent in every case. Does that mean that you're abandoning the MOE program on similar grounds, that you're no longer looking at that, or how do you differentiate between the time the resource constraints were in each?
Well, my concern that I tried to outline is actually not really a resource constraint. It's, I don't know how we would do it. I mean, my point is, how much is the RMB undervalued? Can anyone tell? I mean, if I'm a Commerce Department bureaucrat, can anyone tell me how we're supposed to calculate that on an objective basis? When, as I said, you could call five economists and get five different opinions on the relative valuation. So my concern is not so much that we don't have enough people to throw at the problem. It's I could throw armies of people at the problem. I just don't know how we would do what we're being asked to do. Plus, as I said, the bills ask us to look at currency only in one respect, and that is in the final price of a Chinese good, not to take into account that a low currency in China may make inputs relatively more expensive, but we're not supposed to calculate that. Or what happens if the dollar is relatively weak compared to a foreign currency? We don't calculate that. So it's really more of a practical problem than a resource problem. On the MOE, I read about the letter. I have not yet seen the letter. All I'll say on that is we put out for comment and extended that period of comment the concept of a market-oriented enterprise test, meaning that if there are firms in China that are market-oriented, they would be treated differently in AD/CVD cases. We're still receiving comments. We've not made any decisions about what to do either way. Yes, sir.
Is it accurate to call this trade relationship that we have?
Can you identify yourself, please?
Yes, sir. Rick Leeds of Fairfax. Is it accurate to describe this trade relationship as free trade? And secondly, out of the $260 billion trade deficit, how much of that is going to China's military buildup?
Well, on the first question, I think we have a growing, strong, and mature trade relationship. It is natural in a growing trade relationship that there are tensions. We have a trade relationship with the European Union that is, I think, the largest bilateral relationship in the world in transatlantic trade. And it's quite routine for us to have cases at the WTO or other bilateral disputes. Tensions themselves don't mean that the trade relationship is not working. In fact, they could be the symptom of a relationship that is growing. Now, I outlined three trends that are more than just your typical market access disputes. They are trends that bear watching and trends that we are concerned about. And with regard to the other part of your question, in my previous job, I expressed on a fairly consistent basis concerns about China's military modernization, in particular because it is non-transparent. And there are lots of questions about its intentions. And as my former boss, Deputy Secretary Zelik, said, it is why we hedge our relationship with China, because the purposes behind that military buildup are not well understood and not transparent, and we'll continue to maintain that posture. Sam?
Sam Gilston with Washington Tariff and Trade Letter. You gave a good analysis of the problems trying to use currency in anti-dumping countervailing duty cases. Looking at your decision to apply the countervailing duty laws to China, why don't you face the same problems in trying to separate the subsidies that are pervasive in a communist country and where there's a massive government ownership of resources and control of resources? Why don't you face the same problem, and won't you end up having the Court of International Trade trying to decide the economics of China as well as its currency?
Well, it's a good question, although I do think there are distinctions. We measure government subsidies in CVD cases all the time, whether it's for China or other countries. And in the case of China, the reason we decide to do this is because China is clearly not a market economy. But neither is it a Soviet-style command economy. It's somewhere in the middle. And there are state subsidies, particularly to so-called pillar industries, that we can identify and that we've identified actually fairly readily. They're written about in five-year plans, for example. or there's plenty of public evidence of them from loans, for example, from Chinese state-owned banks. So there's an audit trail there that we feel confident we can follow, and in several cases we've reached preliminary determinations that such subsidies did exist. So I do think there's a distinction. The currency problem is not so much that I don't know what the RMB is trading at. It's that there is no objective international measure of what the proper trading value of currencies is. I mean, the whole purpose behind the Economist Big Mac Index, for those of you familiar with it, is to offer a somewhat tongue-in-cheek way of trying to measure something that economists have a hard time measuring. What is the fair market price of currencies in an international market? Part of the reason to have markets is so that government bureaucrats don't determine what those prices are. So the trouble with inserting currency, Sam, is that we do pride ourselves, despite some who criticize the Commerce Department, we pride ourselves on trying to be objective and transparent in measuring prices in dumping cases or subsidies in CVD cases. The problem here is it is an inherently subjective judgment as to what the value of a currency is compared to another currency. And that shows up in the fact that I guarantee you, go back to your offices and Google, you know, how much is the Chinese currency undervalued? You'll get a lot of different answers. I was told by my staff that even some economists say it's overvalued. So that's the real problem. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I want to ask about the verified end user program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's recently incurred a lot of criticism in the media.
Yes.
On the Wisconsin project, especially calling for it to be repealed. And I was wondering if you saw that program expanding or contracting in the near future.
Well, it's no longer part of my responsibility to decide whether it should expand or contract. That's my colleague, Mario Mancuso, who's the Undersecretary for Industry and Security. But I was involved with establishing the program in my previous job, and what I'll say about it is this. The companies chosen for that program are companies who have very long and established histories of receiving control items under license from the United States. It's not as if these are companies who haven't received things before. They actually have been routinely licensed for this technology over many years. And it was decided after review, not just by the Commerce Department, by the Defense Department, the State Department, with input from the intelligence community, that these would be good candidates for the new program. And as Undersecretary Mancuso has said, it is intended to strengthen national security by focusing our licensing resources on those companies that we don't know as well, and allowing more liberalized treatment for verified end users, or validated end users, excuse me. How soon I forget. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Yanwen here at CSS. Concerning the export license control, I heard that the U.S. may remove some items to China. I'm wondering it's at which level and which item will be removed in the near future.
You can never get away from export controls. Once you do it, you're always going to be asked questions. I'm afraid I don't know, honestly. I have not been doing that job since I was named acting undersecretary last September. So we established the validated end user program, and I'm afraid my colleagues are responsible for that now.
Okay. The other quick question is still under the State Department.
Maybe you're referring to the president just issued two national security presidential directives to streamline export controls, both those administered by Commerce and those administered by State. Doug?
Hi, Doug Palmer with Reuters. This will start with a different topic, but get back to China. Senator Baucus said today that in terms of the FTAs that the Bush administration wants to get through Congress, those aren't going anywhere until there's an agreement on expanding trade adjustment assistance. And so I guess my question in that regard is, will the Bush administration will their posture in those talks be, well, we'll agree to an expansion of trade adjustment assistance only if there's some commitment to take up, say, the Columbia Agreement or possibly all of the agreements? And then I guess my question that gets back to China is, and then once you get involved in conversations like that, isn't it sort of natural to assume that people are going to say, well, we really want to move China legislation of some sort this year? I mean, how are you going to avoid China legislation somehow being right. paired with TAA or FTAs?
On the first part, the president was quite clear the other night. We would like to see the TAA program renewed and improved. I think the administration will look forward to working with Senator Baucus on building a bipartisan consensus for TAA, just as we worked to build a bipartisan consensus around the May 10th agreement. Remember the May 10th agreement, which was to allow the Congress to consider the free trade agreements, not just one free trade agreement, but the free trade agreements. And so I think our view is we look forward to working with Senator Baucus and others to build a bipartisan consensus for TAA. We also need to follow through on the bipartisan agreement that we reached last May to consider the pending free trade agreements, particularly the next one up, which is Colombia, which very much deserves a vote. And on China, I can't really go anything beyond what I said to Chris Nelson. What I've tried to lay out here today is not a case based on linkages and legislative strategies. It's a case based on the substantive merits of two different approaches. One approach is engagement, three-pronged engagement of dialogue, enforcement, and trade remedy law. Another approach is, in my opinion, an approach that runs the risk of inflating prices, encouraging retaliation against our exports at a time when exports are a shining star in our economy, in setting back our efforts to try to solve some of these problems with China that I mentioned, these three big challenges. And again, most importantly, what are we trying to achieve with this China legislation? Is the intent to try to address the deficit? Because the evidence that we have suggests that the deficit is caused by factors that go far beyond just the value of the currency. And that, I believe, is why we have seen a 15% appreciation in the currency and a 30% increase in the trade deficit. It has to do with factors that are far more complex. I understand that it is tempting to focus on currency as the root cause of the problem, but there is very little economic evidence to support that contention. Yes, sir. Yes.
How these nationalist trends in China, how the officials in China would react to congressional action on currency bills or other things like that?
Well, as I said, I think there's a very real risk of retaliation. We are clearly seeing a debate going on inside China between those who supported China's entry into the WTO, who pushed for China's opening up to the world, and those who I think would prefer a return to the old days of more state control and central direction of the economy. And I think that if we take steps along the lines that some of these bills would do, there's a very real risk that there would be retaliation, and not just from China. These bills, many of the sponsors take pains to point out they don't have the word China in them. They could apply to any country where we think there's an undervalued currency. So we could see all kinds of potential retaliation. I am concerned about the risk of retaliation both bilaterally and multilaterally if we were to lose a WTO case on these bills. One more? Yes, ma'am.
Leah from Business Scene. If I understand you correctly, you seem to disapprove what the Chinese government is doing in terms of exercising price controls to fight the inflation. As we all know, the inflation problem in China is getting really serious. And
right.
But as I understand it, these temporary price controls are very much in the interest of the Chinese people, and I think it's very wisely supported by the consumers. In a transitional economy such as in China, I'm wondering what kind of advice you might have for them to deal with inflationary problems.
Well, one piece of advice I would have is to use both fiscal and monetary instruments to deal with inflation. There are many reasons why inflation can exist, and China is frankly limited in the use of monetary policy instruments because of its exchange rate policy. And I think that's about as far as I can go without getting the Treasury really mad at me. So I would just say that when you have a policy of managing your exchange rate, you limit yourself on using monetary monetary policy to deal with inflation, number one. Number two, on the fiscal and other side, I think our advice in the strategic economic dialogue has been to let the market work and to promote more domestic demand-driven growth rather than growth driven only by investment and exports. And these are important factors as well into having a more balanced economic growth situation. So, no, I don't think that price controls and quotas in the world's fourth largest economy are producing the desired result. In fact, I think they're producing shortages and long lines for basic commodities, which is usually what happens when you impose price controls in an economy. And so we would advise other steps to try to deal with China's inflation issue.
Please join me in thanking Chris Padilla for a very excellent talk. Thank you.